Hi, I'm Sharon Davis, Chief Executive of Young Enterprise, and welcome to our podcast series, Transforming Futures. I'll be talking with special guests from different walks of life, all of whom have fascinating life experiences and a shared commitment to helping young people build successful futures. We explore how the powerful chemistry of support and opportunity have shaped their own lives, getting their individual takes on the future skills needed across a range of industry sectors, and what more we can do as a society to help young people build and apply those skills. My guest today is Rachel Hopcroft, CBE, Head of Corporate Affairs at KPMG. For the last 7 years, Rachel has been Head of Corporate Affairs at KPMG UK and is a member of the KPMG's Executive Committee. Rachel leads KPMG UK's Communications External Affairs, Corporate Responsibility and ESG Corporate Reporting teams, overseeing relationships with key stakeholders, including government, the media and charitable partners. Before KPMG, Rachel was a senior civil servant, latterly working in Number 10 and the Cabinet Office as Principal Private Secretary to the Cabinet Secretary. Rachel's a member of the National Literacy Trust Business Leaders Literacy Council and Teach First Business Leaders Council. She also sits on the board of the Alliance to End Malnutrition and Hunger Limited and is a FTSE Women's Leaders Review Steering Group member. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Sharon. It's lovely to be here.
It's a real pleasure to interview you today, Rachel. You've got such a fantastically varied career. My first question is one I ask all of our guests. Now, at Young Enterprise, we often talk about the chemistry of support and opportunity, having the power to transform someone's future. What does that sentence mean to you personally?
I think when I think about those words in the context of my experience, Sharon, I think of two things. I think the first is probably the amazing support that I always had from my family. I grew up in a very big family, a big extended family, and they all had a very, very progressive mindset about what they wanted for the younger generation of the family. So that was always something that I didn't realise at the time, but that was really kind of guiding me and supporting me through childhood into adolescence and then into being a grown up now. But I also think of some really incredible teachers that I had along the way as well. And there was one in particular that really opened up the biggest opportunity for me, really, which was to guide me to go to university, which wasn't something that I was thinking about and wasn't something that I thought I'd be capable of. When I look back now, having his support as well as the way in which he introduced that concept and that idea to me did really change what I then was able to go on and do.
And that sounds really interesting when you talk about that one teacher. It sounds like he really opened a door for you. Can you tell us a little bit more about that particular story?
My English teacher had a daughter who was at university, and I was like, oh, I don't think I want to go, and I don't want to leave home, and I don't think it's for me, and I don't think I'm clever enough. And so he fixed for me to go and visit the university that she was at, which was Lancaster University.
Is that quite away from home for you? Or?
Yeah, it was quite away. I was living just outside Luton at the time. So it was a fair old trek.
Yeah.
And she was really kind of warm and welcoming and showed me round and suggested some things to go and have a look at. And that really did help make, you know, what is quite, what certainly then was quite a big decision for me. So I do owe him an enormous debt, as I have told him when I've seen him, what an amazing opportunity that was for me at that point.
At such a pivotal moment as well.
Yeah, it really was. And it was done in a sort of safe environment as well, because I trusted him and his family were just as supportive and welcoming, really, as he had been. So.
And so you're at Lancaster University, and I've had a little sneak preview of your CV, which is very impressive. So Lancaster to Number 10 to a global corporate. You've got to tell us the story of those transitions.
Well, actually, university to the civil service, which was my first job, was not as big of a shock as I think some people find going from university into the world of work. In part, I think, because I'd always worked. I had good Saturday jobs from when I was 13, and I worked in all my holidays in between being at university, and certainly in the latter years in a sort of office environment, or not doing very glamorous work, but nevertheless in a professional environment. So I never had that, oh my goodness, moment going into the world of work thinking, oh crikey, I'm going to have to get out of bed before 10 o'clock or anything. I didn't really have that.
And tell me, where did that work ethic come from 13, or was that a family thing or?
Yeah, that was definitely part of the family culture, that you earned your own money as soon as you were able to. So, you know, we all had a paper round and that was something that we all did. And then, like I say, as soon as it was possible to do so, me and my brothers were all earning our own money on a weekend. So one of my brothers worked in the local fish and chip shop, so he can tell you everything you need to know about peeling potatoes and battering fish. We worked in the local factories and, you know, we did that, just felt like a very normal thing to do. And it's quite interesting when you talk to young people now, generally speaking, don't really do any of that stuff, in part because I guess labour laws have changed and maybe 13, 14 year olds working in shops on a Saturday isn't even legal anymore. I don't know. But it certainly instilled in me a sense that earning my own money and not being able to just have everything I wanted at any point was not something that happened. We all earned our own money to be able to then spend it on the things that we wanted to. So I guess I've always been a very, very hard worker. But when I got to the civil service, as I say, I was less worried about the hard work, but I was a little bit worried that I didn't feel like I was going to be as clever as everyone else. So I guess I had that feeling that I needed to work twice as hard.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did. And I think that's not uncommon in people that perhaps don't come from such a privileged background. But it also made me kind of run towards the fires a lot. So
what do you mean by that?
From quite a young age in my civil service career, I loved doing the crisis work. So if something was going wrong, I loved being in the thick of it. I loved working out how to fix things. I loved the really kind of fast-paced nature of things. I loved, I quite enjoyed, maybe this is quite a sad thing to say, I quite enjoyed working at the weekends and going into the office, because remote working wasn't such a thing then. But, you know, getting your sleeves rolled up and getting stuff done, whatever the time of day or night, was something that I felt quite excited and energised about, felt like we were doing good things. But I guess what that gave me was a lot of support from quite senior people at quite a junior point in my career, and then a bit more confidence to seek out other opportunities, which perhaps I wouldn't have even thought of had I not, in those early years, had those experiences of the kind of fast-paced, high-octane crisis-type work.
You've got to hold on there, because I've got so much to ask you, from about 125 questions from just that little three or four sentences. So firstly, running to the fires, which just sounds, one, quite scary, but what was it about, had you had an experience where you'd kind of been able to solve a problem that then built you the confidence to then continue to do that? What made you able to do that? It's a big confidence thing, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. So probably the first taste of it was when I was working in immigration in the Home Office, and I had volunteered to go and join a pilot that was looking at how to process asylum seekers in a one-stop shop next to the airport in Heathrow. And it had a processing centre and then a removal centre all in one. Unfortunately, there was a very serious fire because there were too many people being held in this particular centre at that particular point in time. It was all over the news and it was this national emergency. There was a wider public concern at that time that prison population was too high anyway, and that prison and immigration removal centres were overcrowded. So it was playing into what was already going on in the public discourse at that point. And so I ended up working on how to explain what had happened and then what we were doing to take steps to ensure it didn't happen again. And the Home Secretary was obviously very, very interested in what was going on. And we had lots of ministers coming to visit and lots more very senior people from the Home Office coming into environment. It was very, very stressful, obviously, and also very, very distressing for the people that had been caught up in it, as well as for the people that were trying to put it right. But I found that in that environment, I was able to work well with the pressure and even, as I say, not feel overwhelmed by the multiple things that would be going on at any one point in time.
And listening to you, it strikes me that there is a calmness about you in those kind of situations.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that is true. I don't feel a rising panic in those sorts of situations, and the ability to still be able to think clearly is obviously very, very important when things are going badly wrong.
And that's very interesting, because we will have young people listening to this, we'll have educators listening to this. I mean, you need all of those qualities in a team. Yes, you need those loud voices, but you need someone who's able to step back, to be calm, to look at what the options are, etc. Is that a quality you've always had, or is that something you've built over the years?
I think it's probably a quality that's been built. What I had in those early years was the ability to do lots of different things very quickly and thoroughly. I was reading something recently that talked about how the brain changes over time. And when you're younger, your brain is very well suited to doing lots and lots of things at once and quickly and at pace. So, you know, that fast thinking is really, it's suited to younger people. But then as you get older, that's where the ability to be able to step back and to assess a situation and to get perspective on what you're dealing with tends to come to the fore. But I think if you can develop both of those things from a younger point in your career, then I've definitely found that that's stood me in good stead.
And also, I'm struck by what you said about you had some support from senior people who had saw you kind of getting stuff done. I mean, I don't know if you've seen that that clip with Obama, who was interviewed and said, what are you looking for from skills of people? And he said, you know, you just need to have somebody in the room who says, I'm going to get stuff done. How can I help you do that? How can I help, you know, do a job? Have you always been proactive in seeking to find a way of solving problems? I'm thinking, you know, when we think about young people and those skills to develop and the qualities to develop.
I think being able to get things done is such an important skill. And it sounds such an obvious thing to say, doesn't it? But so it seems that there are many more people that find that difficult than you ought to have.
Because so many people define the problem, don't they? They say, this is the problem.
You don't need 20 different people to admire a problem, really. What you do need, though, are a small number of people that can really say, I am going to do that, and then actually go and get it done. I will only say that I will do things when I'm absolutely sure that I can get them done, because I think it's such an important part of wherever you're working, you know, to be able to translate the things that you're talking about into action. I definitely got things done from quite a junior point in my career, and it's still something that guides me today. Just, you know, get stuff done.
Get stuff done. I am writing that down. What would you credit in your journey to date? Would you say your superpower skills were, and how did you build them?
I don't know if I've got any particular superpowers, but maybe the skills that I rely on the most, and that perhaps I take a little bit for granted, but that I think are special skills. I have got a really, really good memory. So generally speaking, I can have almost total recall of conversations, of places, of things that have happened. I can remember them in the right order. If someone asks me, oh, do you remember in 2007 when we were in that meeting with X or Y? I can almost always take myself back and, you know, remember what was happening at that time. And it applies to the short and long term. So,
wow. Because usually it's one or the other, isn't it?
Yeah. So I do worry that at the point at which one of those starts to go, maybe my effectiveness will be affected. But I am very reliant on having a very, very good and sharp memory. I would also say that I'm pretty resilient. And resilience is one of those words that's been discussed loads. You probably talk about it a lot as well, Sharon. But I think some people have just naturally got more resilience than others. You know, they're sort of just, they're born that way. And maybe I'm one of those people. I just have a sort of higher level of resilience. But I do also feel like it is something that needs to be built as well. So I do try and do things to make sure that I'm not taking that for granted, that I will, you know, be resilient to everything, because that's not possible.
Yeah. What do you do to try and build that?
Just create it. I've become much better at creating boundaries. So being less afraid to say no has been a big thing that has built my resilience. But also doing things that give me a bit of joy and life outside of work and family that are for me. So, you know, I don't ever miss my choir practice on a Monday night unless there's something really, really, really important going on.
I didn't know that.
I go to, you know, I love lifting weights. That's a big thing for me. I do that 3 times a week. And again, if I don't do it 3 times a week, I feel like I'm letting myself down, because I know that that is something that is for me and that helps me be a better version of me.
And I don't know about you, but it's took me a while to figure that out. Resilience isn't just about your ability to bounce back all of the time, because that is the route for sure to burnout.
Yeah, absolutely. And also that some people do find things that I don't find difficult or distressing, difficult and distressing. And that's fine. You know, we can't possibly all be the same. We are all going to have different reactions to things and respond differently to things. So having some sense of that, I think, is also really important.
Mm. You strike me as having a very strong sense of yourself.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. I definitely feel I've got to know myself better as I've hit the big 40. Turning 40 definitely felt like a turning point for me. So the last few years, as I've been in my 40s, I have felt like I've got a better sense of myself, yes, and got to know myself a bit better as well.
I'm smiling here because I loved my 40s. 50, not so. So maybe you'll be different. Listen, tell me.
40, that's what they tell us all, Sharon.
Well, yeah, I haven't quite found that yet. I've yet to unlock that that feeling, but it's a work in progress. KPMG, which, you know, you've got a fantastic role there. Just tell me a little bit about that transition.
I was expecting it to be a lot more of a culture shock than it was.
Did you move from number 10 to...
I was working in number 10 in the cabinet office at the time, and it felt like the right time to go and do something something different, because my priorities were changing and I wanted to go and do something that would reflect that a little bit more. I didn't find the transition as difficult as I know others have, and I think that's because there are many more things that big businesses like KPMG and big government departments have in common. And I was able to identify those quite quickly and so, you know, draw on previous experience to help me in a new environment. But also I had worked for lots of different ministers and lots of different senior officials in the civil service. And I had taken for granted probably that was just part of the way of working, that things change and you move on and, you know, you'll be in a department where you're introducing a bill to enable everyone to have an ID card, and then 9 months later you'll be repealing that legislation because a new government have come in and they want to abolish ID cards and the world keeps turning. That ability to roll with the punches, look at new ideas and ways of doing things, actually was very, very useful coming into a business environment, and allowed me again to, I think, establish myself here and get settled reasonably quickly. And look, I was also helped by external events, and you can never take that for granted either. So not long after I came to KPMG, we had the EU referendum. At the point at which I was leaving the civil service, the generally held view was that the Remain campaign would win, and that there would need to be some EU reform after the vote, but that would be it. And of course, that wasn't what ended up happening. And there was an enormous amount of uncertainty for business thrown up as a result. And I was in the business environment where I was able to help explain that a little bit and explain what might be going on in government and help our clients think about the various challenges that they would have as a result of the vote. And so I was able to make myself useful quite quickly in a way that I don't think any of us had expected, but nevertheless had, we were in the situation we were in. It was a bit of a crisis, Again, sort of going back to that running towards the fire, I quite enjoyed being in that environment in those early days in my new role, drawing on those skills that I developed previously. And here I am nearly, well, it's probably 7.5 years now, which have completely flown by. I can't believe it when I say that. But yeah, I'm still here and absolutely loving it.
And there are, I mean, there's clearly synergy, isn't it, from you moving from number 10. And I know at that time there would have been some conversations, certainly early conversations, about the importance of social mobility. And now KPMG UK in particular are doing some groundbreaking work addressing socioeconomic barriers to progression in the workplace. Congratulations. I think you're in the top 5 of the Social Mobility Employer Index in 2023, is that right?
Yeah, we've been in the top 5 since its inception, so we're very proud of that.
So you're clearly committed. I think you've got a commitment to increase the number of leaders from lower socioeconomic backgrounds to 29% by 2030. I know it's important. I'm from that background myself. I feel very passionately about it, as does Young Enterprise. Why is it so important to KPMG to create these opportunities for existing and future leaders?
But I think first and foremost, for me, it's a question of fairness. You know, where you were born and the circumstances into which you're born shouldn't impact where you're able to progress in life. We've also been looking at this through a sort of data-led lens as well. And we did a piece of research that showed the socioeconomic background had the strongest effect on how quickly an individual can progress through our firm. And what it showed was that individuals from a lower socioeconomic background took on average 19% longer to progress to the next grade when compared to those from a higher socioeconomic background. And when we discovered that, we were very, very keen to then look at how to put that right, because that can't be the case that could be allowed to stand. And I think making sure that once you have that data in front of you, that you do something about it. You know, we were talking earlier about getting stuff done. The easy thing to do would have been to sit back and admire that data and then admire the problem and then move on to the next thing. But actually, what's much more important is to do something about it. And the first thing to do about it was to admit, not just to ourselves internally, that that was what we had found, but also to open that up to a much wider audience to see that we were really looking at this data and were therefore doing something about it. Because I guess the more, you know, you can highlight these things and you can kind of help people understand the impact of someone's socioeconomic background, the more we can then create better outcomes for everyone. So that was certainly where we were headed when we were thinking about this.
I've got a personal question on this one. In terms of that socioeconomic background having such almost like kind of 20% longer than others, is that what we're saying? 19%, 20%? Yeah. When I was growing up, and certainly very early in my career, the social cues of things I didn't know when I walked in a room of how to behave, or certainly, you know, certain, I mean, dinners to this day around the cutlery thing just really do my head in. I really still struggle with that kind of like cutlery thing, you know, the vast variety of things.
Yeah. What knife will talk to you?
That's it. That's it. I usually sit next to someone and I just watch them go for it first, or I don't answer. But what are some of the reasons that contribute to that 20% in the work that you've done?
There's definitely some of the things that you're alluding to in there. How polished is someone is often the way the academics would refer to it, which is what you're talking about. You know, how well you interact at a dinner party. Can you talk about going skiing? Are you wearing the right clothes? Have you got the right accent? If career advancement is based on those things alone, that is obviously deeply unfair, but has nevertheless formed part of what has gone before. So, you know, how do you really think about allowing someone to realise their potential rather than focusing on those things that you're talking about, which really in the end don't matter at all? You know, they are just so irrelevant to somebody's potential and somebody's ability. Lots of leaders will tell you this, but leading more diverse teams is harder than leading a group of people that are all very much like you. And breaking out of that is another big challenge as well. You know, how do you create those diverse groups and diverse teams rather than recruiting in your own image, who, you know, and if you are from a better off background, those sorts of people might be the ones that you more naturally gravitate towards.
And so this journey, in lots of ways, you've worked hard to try and build out new ways of working. So just very quickly, what are a couple of the things that you've found have really worked in taking those initial steps to get to that point of being in the top five social mobility employers?
One of the things that we found quite early on was a real issue was work experience. If you're from a better off background, the likelihood is that you've got more professional people in that network, and therefore, you know, you can phone up your dad's mate and say, can I come and do work experience with you? And that just wasn't fair. So we introduced a scheme here that we just called, it does exactly what it says on the tin, which was the 1+1 scheme. So, you know, we didn't stop people from being able to provide those opportunities. But what we did say was, if you're going to let your son's friend come and do work experience here, we will also take somebody from a lower socioeconomic background who could then have the same experience. And we did that by working with local schools and through an organisation that helped facilitate it, so that we were giving an opportunity that somebody with an already existing network had to somebody that didn't have it. And of course, lots of the research shows that the more touch points you have with businesses and employers at a younger age, the greater the likelihood is that you'll get into meaningful work when you become an adult. So that felt like something that was really very straightforward, really, that wasn't going to be a huge administrative burden for us.
And just to build on that, because that's an element of applied learning, isn't it? That's providing a consistent opportunity for a young person to apply and translate knowledge into skills. And if I may, I'll just share an example of that in terms of, obviously, that's a big passion for Young Enterprise. We feel that applied learning is really important. And I'll share an example of one of our Young Enterprise alumni who now works at KPMG, actually. Nicola Webb participated in our company programme, where she ran a Young Enterprise student company for a year. And at a local final in Oldham, a KPMG UK judge saw real potential in Nicola and created, as we've talked about, that sliding door moment, and suggested that Nicola apply for a KPMG work experience to find out more about the industry. And get this, 10 years later, Nicola is well on her way to becoming a fully chartered accountant, hopefully by November 2024, with KPMG having accessed the apprenticeship programme. And so that combination, that critical chemistry of support and opportunities, has massively influenced that person's future. Amazing. What more can the business sector do to help create more applied learning opportunities, particularly in that critical transition from education into work?
Yeah, I mean, I love that story of Nicola. I'm going to look her up after this call and make sure that I say hello. I think it's incumbent on the business community to provide those sorts of opportunities as early as possible. You know, the earlier that we can get kids thinking much more about the link between education and work, frankly, the better. And, you know, we've got a fantastic scheme running at the moment, actually, that we've called Opening Doors to Opportunities. And that is all about helping young people to be able to experience being in a big organisation like KPMG. In some cases, we're doing this with primary schools now, because getting that sense of what it's like when you finish school and when you finish your education and where you're going to go, you know, allowing people the opportunity to be able to maybe set their sights a bit higher than they thought that they might be able to be capable of at an early age just feels like the right thing to do. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here in our big office in Canary Wharf, and we're nestled in quite a deprived part of East London. And the more schools that we can get around here to come and have a nose around our building and experience what it's like to be a consultant or an auditor or a tax advisor, frankly, the better, because it's just possible that one or two of them might think, actually, yeah, I'm going to have a crack at doing that.
Absolutely. Opening doors to opportunities. So we've got an educator who is interested in finding out more. There'll be information on your website or something, will there?
Yes, absolutely loads. And I'm very happy to connect directly with anyone that's interested and tell them a little bit more about it and how schools in particular can get involved.
Brilliant. I have one more question with you, if I may. And it's related to resilience. I know we talked about, you mentioned resilience. A big part of our work is partnering teachers. We've invited teachers to really ask industry leaders like yourselves practical questions that help them prepare young people for the world of work. Here's a great one. It's just for you, this one. As a teacher, how can we champion behaviours like resilience and job satisfaction for Gen Z?
My first thought when it comes to thinking about the younger generations is making sure that you've got the right setup to really hear from them about what they want. How do they want to learn? How do they want to be taught? How do they want to do their work? That's not to say that you should be calling all the shots, but making sure that they do feel seen and heard and listened to is definitely something that we do a lot of in our organisation, getting that understanding. And that they do want different things than perhaps generations that have gone before do. It's also something that we've been really thinking about a lot as a big British business, but as you said earlier, also a global business. And lots of other companies are thinking this way, which is Gen Z definitely want to see much greater transparency on social and societal issues from their employer. But with that comes a lot of expectation that, you know, a big business will have an opinion about what's going on in Israel, Gaza at the moment, or what was happening during the Black Lives Matter period after the awful murder of George Floyd. So, you know, there's a much greater expectation on lots of businesses, but also on education and establishment schools as well, to reflect a bit of that as well. So, you know, how do teachers start to incorporate and reflect, you know, a much broader sense of what's happening in the world and, you know, teach that critical thinking from a young age so that particularly in an era of social media and fake news that you are able to really sort of think critically for yourself rather than rely on necessarily, you know, the interpretations of others. That's certainly been something that's been on my mind for a while.
And that links back to something you were talking about earlier, that critical thinking and then the ability to apply that within various settings, you know, whether that be problem solving. Again, I'm thinking about running to the fire and not admiring the problem.
Yeah, I mean, on resilience in particular for young people, I know this is something that lots of people worry about. And now with two young children of my own, I think about it a lot as well. We do have to let our children, but also our teams, maybe our students, if we're teachers, we have to let them fail sometimes. They have to experience what it's like to not always be, you know, wrapped up in cotton wool and everything taken care of and looked after. And that is hard. And I think for reasons I don't quite understand, I think that has become harder. But when you fail or when something goes wrong or when someone isn't there making everything just kind of nice and smooth for you, that does build resilience. Having very occasionally to stand on your own 2 feet in an environment that's safe to do so. But that is important. That is what builds resilience. You've got to mess up a few times and you've got to sort of make some decisions that didn't quite work out.
And I'd agree with that, because in a startup setting, failure is absolutely part of the cycle of innovation and, you know, an iteration. Whereas in various other settings in the UK, failure is very much attached to shame and judgment and all of those things. And I think there is a lot of work in the UK to do where we should look at startup culture and the importance that failure places in that learning curve. So it's a brilliant shout there.
I didn't reflect on the element of job satisfaction that teacher raised. Mm. That is definitely a danger as we see the rise of AI and technology and automation and all of these terms that we're all sort of thinking about at the moment. How do we create really meaningful jobs for the workforce of the future? And therefore, how do we ensure that, you know, there is the job satisfaction that I feel I've massively enjoyed in the last 20 years of my career? But also, I think individuals do have to take some of that responsibility on themselves as well. Really find the things that you like to do. And that is maybe that's a bit of a glib thing to say sometimes, but you generally get really good job satisfaction when you combine the things that you enjoy with the things that you're good at. And often in life, people will like be good at something, but they really don't like doing it. Or they really, really enjoy something, but there's no money in it, or they can't make a living out of it. And neither of those scenarios are particularly good for kind of overall satisfaction. But if you can find some things that you're good at with things that you enjoy, that's like the dream.
It is. And that's a brilliant point, I'm afraid, to end on. Because that's it for this episode of Transforming Futures, Rachel. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today and sharing your own journey so honestly and so powerfully. Thank you for your incredible work that you're leading at KPMG UK to increase young people's access to opportunity, increasing social mobility, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Sharon. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Next week, I'll be speaking with Ian Howells, Senior Vice President at Honda Motor Europe, about the skills that make a better leader, including the use of empathy in a pretty extraordinary situation. Look out for that podcast, which will be available next week.